Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. We're told that getting a college degree or even a graduate degree is essential for remaining competitive in current and future job markets. But we all know that this leg up comes at a high cost. Untenable student loan payments have become a political focus in recent years, but why are the costs of post-secondary education so high in the first place? And what are the schools doing with all of that tuition money? Today is the first installment of a new series on Midday, The Cost of Higher Ed. Each Tuesday for the next 3 weeks, we're going to focus on this subject. And today, we start by looking at why it seems like tuition increases every single year, and at how universities are spending that money, and what, if anything, is being done to control those costs. I'm joined by Meredith Callender, a higher education reporter at the Hechinger Report, and by Jeffrey Selingo, a contributor to the Washington Post and former editor at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welcome to you both.
Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as well. How much have you seen your tuition increase in the past year? Is there a line item maybe on your most recent bill that took you by surprise? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Maybe we can help you figure out what's going on with your child's tuition and what it actually pays for. Again, that's 212-433-9692, or tweet us at WNYC Midday, or just leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So Meredith and Jeff, let's just start with the baseline here. How much has tuition increased on average, in both public and private universities over the past 5 years, say? Meredith, do you have that number?
I can tell you that in New York State, tuition has gone up at the public universities, the four-year public universities, by about 20%. That is a lot, but there are places like Louisiana where it's gone up 58%. 58, yeah. Mississippi, 30%. West Virginia, 34%. So it's tough in New York, and then it's even tougher in other states.
And these are big numbers when we're talking about in absolute terms, right? Sort of the dollar amount. We're thinking 58% increase over. What are we talking about? Average on average, like over what number over to what number? Or just to give us a sense of, like, are we talking about, you know, $1,000 a year tuitions or $20,000 a year tuitions?
I mean, New York is among the lower, not the lowest, but it's about 12th in the state. SUNY will run you about $6,670. CUNY about similar, about $6,500. But just one note, tuition and fees is not how much it costs to go to college. Mm-hmm. There's also the actual cost of attendance. CUNY itself estimates that if you are living away from home, it's going to cost $20,000 a year to go to CUNY.
Right. Jeff, you were trying to jump in?
Well, I think some of these percentages sound big. I guess the good news is the percentage increases have actually been going down this past decade compared to the previous decade. But the problem is, you know, inflation is low and earnings are flat. And so even though the annual increases by publics and privates are smaller in this decade than in previous decades, I think for most families, it's seeming like a lot more. Most students who go to public colleges go to in-state public colleges that charge less than $15,000 a year. We were talking about New York State there, right? $6,000-$7,000 a year, which is still a lot of money. But, you know, I think when people think about college costs, they think about these numbers that are thrown out often for private colleges, the sticker price, you know, $50,000-$60,000. You know, the average sticker price now of a four-year college, including room and board, is around $47,000. But we also know that, not everybody pays that. A survey that just came out a couple weeks ago showed that the average discount rate at private colleges is about 49%. So they take off about 50% of that that sticker price that you actually pay for in what's called net tuition.
But just thinking about the price itself, Jeff, on private schools, do you know if sort of the pace of growth, does it match the pace of growth of public schools?
Privates have actually been a little bit slower than public schools in the last decade because the market forces are slightly different there. And they also don't get an appropriation from the states. And what's happened in many states is that higher education is typically called the balance wheel of state budgets. So when there's little money left at the end of the day, they know they can charge students more in tuition. You know, you can't charge prisoners. Medicaid spending is way up in the states. You know, you can't charge more for that. So there's an out in states, and that's charging tuition. And so it's a lot easier for lawmakers to say, yeah, we'll put money in these other programs, but not higher education because we can charge students more in tuition.
And Meredith, that is very much a trend, again, for public universities in terms of where what's going on with resources is that they are getting the funding is being cut, correct? Is that when did that start? That started probably with the 2008 recession?
The big dip started in 2008, and most states are still spending less than they were in 2000 before the recession. On higher education. So even though there has been recovery, states have started to spend a little bit more, it's still below what it was pre-recession. And I just wanted to go back to the study that Jeff just mentioned about the discounted rates, because that is something that a lot of students don't necessarily know that they can do. Those are the private colleges that are discounting their sticker prices, but that is not need-based. And the idea that you can bargain with a college or ask for a scholarship or they'll give you one is something that's good for all students to know, because that tends to be that isn't based on income. That's based on kind of knowledge and desirability, and also just because enrollment has been going down, the private colleges are competing for some students.
And we'll talk in some detail about enrollment in a minute, but say more about this bargaining with your college idea. So you're saying it's not just, there's the question of your financial aid, right? I can't afford this. You apply for financial aid. There's a whole separate question of saying, give me a better deal than you got, right? I mean, is that a thing people do?
That is kind of a thing that people
do. Well, I think
Jeff, go ahead.
I think what's happening is...
Jeff, 1 second. Go ahead and finish your thought, Meredith.
That is kind of a thing that people do. You do get need-based aid. You can apply for merit scholarships. But when you apply to a college, there are like 2.6 million fewer students enrolled right now. So when you apply to a college, you can actually go back to them and say, you know, I'd like to come, but I can't afford your sticker price. Can you lower it? But to do that, you know, the sort of confidence and knowledge that you can do that tends to be more resource students, more upper middle class students,
right,
or ones that have really aggressive, focused college counselors.
Jeff, what were you trying to say?
You know, it's really an enrollment management tool. It's not a financial aid tool. So what's happening is that, you know, private colleges can't get, except for the most elite selective institutions, they can't get somebody to pay, you know, even people who can afford it, they can't get them to pay $50,000 a year. And so what they do is they discount it, thinking, well, there's very complicated formulas, and there's a huge industry that has risen up around higher education to help them do this, where they say, well, if we give them $5,500 quote-unquote scholarship, which is really a discount, they'll end up paying the rest because they can. And so there's these formulas, you know, $5,500, $6,500, $7,500, and that's where the negotiation comes in. Well, if you give me another $500 this year, another $1,000, I'll come. And as Meredith says, it's really among the kind of the upper middle and upper class families who, A, know how to negotiate this, but more so they're kind of in the key group here for these colleges, because these colleges can't, in most cases, can't afford to give too many full scholarships, meaning you don't pay anything. They need to get some revenue from these students, and the only students they can get those from are upper middle and middle and upper class families.
Listeners, we want you to join this conversation. Again, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. If you have questions or thoughts about your own tuition or your child's tuition. And let's bring in Caitlin from Montclair. Caitlin, hello, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good, how are you?
Very good. What's going on with your tuition, Caitlin?
So I'm going to be a junior at my liberal arts college in Massachusetts, and tuition has slowly been increasing about 4.25% each year. And a lot of students who both receive financial aid, as well as students who don't receive financial aid, such as myself, went to a tuition transparency meeting to try to see, you know, where tuition was going, and specifically where our tuition was going within the college. And even though, you know, we got some answers, it wasn't as transparent as I believe the college would have liked to see it. There was a recent building of a athletic complex within the school that I just looked it up. It was about probably, with the whole athletic center, was about $95 million, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And that is specifically for only athletes at the school. So as someone that's a non-athlete, all of that money that was going towards there was not even for me, and it's just a matter of where is my tuition, which is now, including room and board, more than $70,000. Where is that specifically going? And
thank you for that, Caitlin. I need to cut you off for a second. Can you guys comment on this tuition transparency question that she's talking about? Is this a growing trend that schools and the folks who are paying tuition at those schools sort of expect to have this transparent conversation about where the money goes? Meredith or Jeff, whichever
one of you. She just brought up an interesting point about buildings, which of course have been going up. They're typically funded by, you know, bonds that are paid off over time, but sometimes those things are paid for by student fees. And it's, you know, we tend to talk about tuition. We don't tend to talk about fees and room and board, right, which just continue to add over to the total price. And at some places, you know, in Georgia, for example, the student fees could be even higher than the actual tuition. And these are fees that students over time have voted to put in place. And it's very easy for a student to vote for, you know, a new technology fee, a new athletics fee, a new fee for recreation or whatever it might be, because they'll be gone in a couple of years and there'll be somebody else paying them. So I think part of the transparency here is not only about tuition, but it's also about these huge increases in fees in many states.
Right.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch some students. I do think there's a somewhat of a transparency movement going on. They're saying this is our money and we want to know how it's being spent. Everything from faculty, diversity in faculty, athletic buildings versus instructional support, things like that. Universities are genuinely caught in a very tough bind. They have less money coming from the state, so state appropriation is down. And then at the same time, they're trying to attract more students, more full freight students, because so much more of the money is now coming from tuition. So it's interesting there. The universities themselves are carrying a lot of debt. We talk a lot about student debt, but the universities themselves, last year they borrowed $41 billion,
wow,
which is up from $29 billion just a decade ago. And part of it is what Jeff was saying, going to building new buildings, state-of-the-art dorms, things that will attract those full-paying students.
And is the reduced funding, I know you mentioned that it started with the 2008 recession. How much of that also, though, had to do with a change in political climate? I'm thinking about sort of the 2010 wave of state legislatures flipping to becoming far more conservative, people that are thinking less about particularly spending on public higher education. Is that part of the trend as well, or is that irrelevant?
I got my career started covering state higher education back in the late 90s, and this goes back, you know, much further than the 2008 recession. I think that kind of accelerated the trend, but we've been seeing now for decades state lawmakers beyond kind of the politics of higher education, which we could probably put aside for a second, but basically thinking, you know, higher education is a private good, not a public good. And the idea that you're going to go to college, you're going to get a degree, you're going to make more money means that you should have to contribute more money to the cost of your education. And I'll never forget back in the late 90s talking to lawmakers about student loans in particular, and they would say, well, you know, if a student has to take $20,000 out to pay for their degree, that's a cost of a new car. You know, that seems like a pretty good deal to me. And so I think the attitudes perhaps have shifted around the politics of higher education, but for the most part around this cost issue, I think they go back decades, where we've moved from higher education as a public good in the 60s to higher education as a private good probably starting in the 80s, 90s.
Yeah, and absolutely. I know for New York State, it used to be 10 or 15% in the late 80s of the money came from tuition, and now it's up to 40% comes from tuition. So that's just a flip in terms of putting the onus not on the government or community or society, as you want to say, but on the individual.
I'm Kai Wright, and I'm speaking with Meredith Colander, higher ed reporter at The Hechinger Report, and Jeffrey Selingo, author and editor at large for The Chronicle of Higher Education, joins us for our first installment of our new series, The Costs of Higher Education. Listening to Midday on WNYC, I'm Kai Wright, and I'm speaking with Meredith Colander, higher ed reporter at the Hechinger, the Hechinger Report, and Jeffrey Selingu, author of an editor at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We are talking about the cost of higher ed, and I want to go to Farah in New Jersey. Farah, I understand you have a question for our guest. What's your question?
I do. So I'm an international student, and I go to Rutgers University in New Jersey, which is, of course, a state university. And what I pay is double what in-state students pay, and even more than what out-of-state students pay who are from the U.S. So I'm wondering how universities use the idea of international students to their advantage to profit from people coming from other countries, because obviously I can't qualify for government-based financial aid, so I have to rely either on the money that, you know, like my family has or I have, or on private loans.
Yeah. Meredith, thank you for that question, Farah. Meredith, I see you nodding aggressively. I take it international students are probably these full freight students we're thinking about that universities can pick up their costs with.
Yeah, that's right. There is actually a lot of marketing and advertising that's going on overseas by universities that you wouldn't necessarily think would do that, but it is just because I think most of the reason is financial, which is places like the University of Alabama, University of Arkansas, you see a growing percentage of their students from overseas, and part of the big reason is that they can charge much more.
Yeah. Jeffrey.
And not just overseas, but also out of state. Meredith mentioned the University of Alabama, which has more freshmen from out of state than it does from Alabama. And this causes a lot of, you know, there's a big debate over this. You know, the caller was seemed to talk about how unfair this was, maybe, that she had to pay more. But people in the state would say, you know, they're taking spots from us, right? That there's students from, you know, in the state who may not get into these places at a lower tuition rate. But this is how public universities in particular have been trying to make up for these declines in state funding, was to look for new revenue sources. And the new revenue source is students who pay twice as much on average.
Well, and Meredith, you wrote in October, it seems like this is related, that, you know, quote, more than half of the country's top public universities replace low-income students with affluent ones over the past 14 years. This is part of the same trend,
I imagine. That is part of the same trend. And I do think that in some states, there are students who have become active around this issue because the mission of those public universities, as stated, is to serve the students, the residents of that state, which you can argue with one way or the other. To make it more diverse by having people from out of state is a benefit. But specifically, if you look at, I did a story about the flagships, the state flagships, and the percentage, for instance, of Black students who were enrolled at the flagships versus the percentage of Black high school students in the states. There are huge gaps there.
Flagships being the premier public institution in a given state.
Correct. Like the University of California at Berkeley or...
Right. Yeah. Got it. Let's talk to Aaron from... Aaron, where are you? I'm sorry. I'm
in Northern New Jersey.
Northern New Jersey.
Teaneck, Leoni area. So I sent my oldest daughter to Drexel, or she sent herself, actually, more accurate. It was far cheaper than going to Rutgers in state. But Rutgers is an example of one of those state in-state schools that, as a tuition, is by and far the most expensive in the United States. And and I see on the East Coast. I grew up on the West Coast. Just how many fewer public big state universities there are. I mean, New York is kind of an exception, and parts of Massachusetts are. But overall, I mean, for a region this size, compared to California, Oregon, or Washington, Arizona, Nevada, et cetera, you just don't have that kind of UC system type model out here. And it just creates this huge disparity between private and public universities, where if you're one of the elite graduates, of course, you can go to most public schools for free. Or if you're below maybe 50 grand a year and do really well on tests. But if you're in that 50 to 200 grand a year zone, I mean, you're paying basically full freight at any public school.
Thanks for that, Aaron.
Yeah.
Is this true? Can we fact check what he said? Do either of you know if it's true that Rutgers is in fact the most expensive university, public university in the country?
I mean, I don't know if it's most expensive. I mean, the North, you know, the Mid-Atlantic, Northeast publics tend to be higher priced than the publics in the South and the West. They also tend to give out a little bit more aid. They follow this mantra of high tuition, high aid model. It's also true in New Jersey, by the way. New Jersey exports more students than any other state in the country, right? So given the population of New Jersey, there are very few public and private universities in New Jersey. And so most of those students end up going to Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, and even further afield. I think it's interesting what he said was, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about tuition discounts. And so what ends up happening is that publics and privates in some cases, such as in his case, are somewhat equal at the end of the day with the net price that you end up paying, because at Drexel he got such a discount that it ended up being the same amount as paying, you know, the full price of public in a place like New Jersey. And I think that's very true, which is why, again, especially in a place like New Jersey, most of those students end up going out of state, and a lot of them end up going to privates.
I don't think I quite followed the idea of why there's a different regional model for these public universities in terms of what drives costs.
It's historical. You know, it's the migration of the U.S. population over time. You know, most we kind of never agreed as a nation to have like a public higher education system. So most states were responsible for their own starting their own systems. You know, in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, because of the age of those states, they started them well before the kind of the public model of higher education, particularly with the land-grant universities during the Civil War in the 1860s. So it's just historical that, you know, the Northeast tends to, and the Midwest tends to have more private colleges and universities than the South and the West, which tend to have a lot more publics.
And what about solutions here, Meredith? I know here in New York State, we've got this tuition-free degree program we're launching, the Excelsior Scholarship. Can you explain that program and what it's about? And it's a groundbreaker, as I understand it, right?
Yes, it is the first of its kind in the country in that it offers free tuition for both community colleges and four-year public universities. That's SUNY and CUNY. Most of the free tuition programs, there are about 19 or 20 of them now, focus on the two-year community colleges, although there are very important exceptions to that. That being said, free tuition doesn't mean it's free to go to the college, if you know what I mean. It does pay for tuition, which is really important, but there's a few other things that are important to know about it. There are about 23,000 students who are benefiting from it right now. Those tend to be students that are in the 60,000 to 110,000 income range, because it's what's known as a last dollar scholarship, which means that the students who are low income qualify for the Pell Grant, the federal Pell Grant, and in New York, the tuition assistance program, TAP, and that covers their tuition. So Excelsior is mostly going to the sort of mid-range $60,000 to $110,000. You have to go full-time, so it's going to mostly more traditional students that don't have family obligations or, you know, are going part-time. And it only covers tuition, just to be clear. You can't Pell Grants. You can use anything that's left over for books or transportation or things that are college-related. This will pay your tuition.
So,
and you have to stay in the state afterwards, or else it converts into a loan, which I think is an important factor for people to remember.
So neither of you sounds terribly impressed with this program, and it's supposed to. And it is one of the more forward-looking ones in the country, I gather. Right? I mean, that's a depressing idea about where we stand.
I think it was, you know, I'm not that impressed with it because I've done a lot of work in the South, where a lot of stories in the South around scholarship programs that were similar back in the late 90s and the early part of last decade. And I think the big piece of this that and is the piece I just mentioned at the very end, right? If you end up going out of state to work after college, for every year of the, if you got the scholarship for 3 years and you stay in the state for 3 years, you're fine. But for every year you go out of state after college, it turns into into a loan. And so, the job market is very dynamic. You could probably work in the city and some other places around the state, but I think it kind of handcuffs students after graduation to work in the state if they don't want it to convert into a loan.
Yeah, I think the question is also, what's the goal of a scholarship program? If the goal is to help some students financially to afford college, this does that for, I think it's about 3% of SUNY students. If the goal is to help students go to college who wouldn't otherwise go to college, I'm not sure that is what Excelsior is about.
Mm-hmm.
This is more helping students who... they'll have less loans.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be easier. There's nothing bad about it in that sense.
Right.
It should exist. The people shouldn't be. I think the average public college graduate in New York State is like $30,000 in debt when they graduate, and that's not really okay. The other thing I just wanted to say about Excelsior and all these programs that are coming up in terms of scholarship and free tuition is sort of why it matters now versus when in the late 80s when things started changing in terms of tuition, mm-hmm. which is that for most decent paying jobs in this country, you now need some sort of post-secondary degree. It could be an associate's, it could be a certificate, it could be a 4-year, but it's very hard to make a family sustaining wage on just a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So.
And it's increasingly hard to make it on a college degree as well. I mean, with incomes not going up. Go ahead, Jeff.
I think that was an important point right there at the end that Meredith mentioned around associate's degrees. You know, one thing we haven't really talked about so far is we've been talking about 4-year colleges and universities and not necessarily talking about the huge sector of community colleges where about 40% of American students go. And, average community college tuition is around $3,500 a year. It's essentially free for low-income students in most states who get a full Pell grant. But it's increasingly becoming a way for even middle-income and upper-middle-income students to start college, right? So this survey that comes out every year about how Americans pay for college, more than 25% now of people who go to community colleges come from families making over $100,000 a year. Before 2008, that was less than 10% of that student body. And so what's happening now is you see wealthier parents or even middle-income families who used to start at a 4-year college say, my son or daughter doesn't quite know what to do. Mm-hmm. They're not quite, I'm not quite sure they're ready for college. Let's start at a community college and transfer to a 4-year college, which I think is a great pathway in states where those transfer pathways exist.
Let's on this question of debt, I want to hear from Linda in Staten Island, who I understand has a story about this very thing. Hi, Linda. You're on WNYC.
Hi there, and thanks for this program. I'll just preface it by saying we were a middle-class family, and then we became newly poor. My daughter was homeschooled, actually took an online high school program to get a diploma in New York, because without sitting in front of a licensed New York teacher, you cannot get a diploma in New York, and that keeps you out of SUNY also without taking SATs and Regents. At any rate, in one of her classes on personal finance, they spent half the semester on student debt. And I am so glad they did, because she was it prepared her to look at how it would roll out over 4 years, mm-hmm. or maybe even 5 years. She got accepted into the only college that she was interested in up in Vermont, and after two semesters, when she considered that she would have about $30,000 in debt at the end, and she just felt that was not sustainable, that realistically, for the kind of job she would be prepared for, she didn't think it was worth it to go forward. And so, I was...
And so did she stop?
No. I just threw it out to her to speak to anybody, her advisor, her academic advisor, the financial aid office. She went with her mind made up just to say, I'm gonna have to withdraw because the debt I will have will be unsustainable. And those were the key words, I think, because they found they found another $6,000 almost. She had a
from guaranteed. When she went to negotiate, they found some more money for her.
She didn't go to negotiate. She didn't know she was going to negotiate. She was just going to say, I love it. I'm a good student, but I won't be able to afford this when I get out.
Thank you for that story. Meredith, I have to say, it rings a bell for me. I did very much the same thing at a private university. I couldn't afford it. I went back and I said, I can't afford it. I got to go. But they just loaded me up with more debt that, honestly, I frankly never paid. Have you heard stories like this?
I mean, all the time. It's distressing because it's understandable why you would drop out, and then long term, it could really hurt you financially. There are some places. Georgia State is the most well publicized, but other universities are doing it now as well, where they see a student who is near to completing. It's called a retention grant, and they will just add that extra $1,000, $1,500 into their account so that they can make it to graduation. Mm. And the results have been fairly amazing. The graduation rates have gone up.
So it's like an emergency grant.
Exactly.
Well, we will have to leave it with that. We will be talking about these same subjects over the next few weeks. We'll be looking at data available on how much money goes to paying teachers. We'll be looking at work-study programs. We're going to dig into this and really try to understand it. Next week, the next installment of the series will in fact focus on work-study and adjunct professors. That'll be next Tuesday. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kai Wright.
It's great to be here.
I'm Kai Wright, and I've been speaking with Meredith Colander, higher ed reporter at the Hechinger Report, and Jeffrey Selingo, author and editor-at-large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, for the first installment of our new series, The Costs of Higher Ed.